And I actually am gonna start with a story of the, you know, fictional kind, if you will. Had this lovely, happy family surprise kind of sprung on me a couple weeks ago. Actually, I guess it's a little longer than that now, but because we had to get tickets. But it was my birthday recently, and part of the gift that I received was the opportunity to go with Tyrion and an adult family friend and his son, who's about the same age, to see this How to Tame Your Dragon spectacular at the train. I always get them confused. I've got Tame and Train. If you wanted to see my notes, I had Train typed and I crossed it out this morning and wrote Tame. So obviously, there's an ongoing confusion. And at the MTS Center, and it was spectacular. It was stunning. What these guys put together for a live show was incredible. And so I was already enjoying it at a whole bunch of levels. And then, about a third of the way in, all of a sudden I realized what the story actually was for me. And I realized it was the same story in its essence that I wanted to talk about this morning in terms of a story from the Bible. And of course, it's not advertised that way, and it's not characterized that way. It's not structured visibly that way. But what's going on inside and underneath this story just kind of knocked me over. And I kind of spent the whole rest of the evening kind of just pinned to my seat, holding my breath a little bit, kind of going, I can't, this is incredible. So that was my experience. Obviously, not everyone in the MTS Center was having that experience. The people, you know, five and under were mostly preoccupied with the big fire-breathing things, which were incredible. But what I want to do this morning is I want to recap that story for you, and then I want to kind of let you in on what I felt like I was hearing was really going on in there as it sits with a particular text that I think has something to say to us. So the story of How to Train Your Dragon more or less goes like this. There's this island, it's called Burk, and this island is plagued by attacks from dragons. The culture of the island, generally speaking, is sort of a pseudo-Viking culture. It's a bleak place, it's cold, it's when it's wet at all, it's damp. It has a long, wretched winter. It sounds remarkably like some other places that people choose to live. And there's this chieftain, Stoic. Stoic the Vast. Great names in this thing. Stoic the Vast, he's kind of the Uber Viking. He's the guy in this story. He's the chieftain. And he has this kind of winsome loser son named Hiccup. And it's better than Boo Boo. Anyway, so this son called Hiccup, and Hiccup is really well-meaning, but he just messes things up. He just kind of sets out to do the right thing and turns it into catastrophe, you know, burns half the village down kind of stuff. And he's always kind of goofing up. He so passionately wants to be a Viking. He wants to be everything that a Viking should be. And that's partly why he keeps messing up, because he's just trying too hard, you know. But one night, he's out, and of course, part of what it means to be a Viking in this particular setting is to deal with dragons. Because the real scourge of Burk is the dragon community that's nearby. And these dragons are always kind of showing up, and they're attacking the village, and they're burning things down, and they're running off with the livestock, and they're just generally causing havoc. So to be a Burkian Viking full-on is to be one that has mastered dragons, either by killing them or by training them. Those are sort of the two options. And Hiccup really wants to be one of those people. So one night, Hiccup is out kind of lamenting his most recent screw-up, and he sees a dragon fly over, and he's kind of invented this unique weapon that fires out like a big net, and so he fires it at this thing, and he thinks it's a dragon called a Night Fury. And Night Fury is unique in this story setting because it's a dragon that people talk about, they believe it exists, but that nobody ever sees. So it's an idea. And he fires this weapon at this Night Fury, and he hits it, and it goes down into the forest. And he is absolutely sure that he has slain a Night Fury. But he can't prove it. And he goes back to the village and with this story, and kind of nobody's kind of buying it. Eventually what happens is he pursues it into the forest, and he finds it in the forest. Meantime, what has happened regarding the dragon attacks, because the last one was a doozy, is that Stoic, his father, has assembled a crew of Viking warriors, and they've gotten onto their ships, and they've sailed off to find the dragon's nest, where they all reside, to deal with this dragon problem once and for all. So Hiccup starts searching the forest, and he finds this dragon that he shot down. It's alive, but it has a broken tail. It's been injured. It's one of its steering wings is busted. And so, but it's still tangled up in this net. And so he thinks, this is it. Like, this is my chance to be a real Viking. I am going to kill a Night Fury. Not only did I shoot one down, but now I'm going to kill it. And I am going to be all that I kind of have dreamed of being. And the village will see that. And Astrid, the would-be love of my life, will see that. And I'll get the girl as well. And it's all going to be awesome. And he gets out his knife and he runs at this dragon and he just can't do it. He can't kill it. Just like right up to it. Just like, he tries. In the live production, he kind of gives three goes at it. You know, like he wants this so bad. And he just can't do it. So he cuts it free. And sort of by trial and error, he befriends this dragon. Names it Toothless, which is a great name in context, but it's because it has retractable teeth, ostensibly, but there's other reasons, of course, in the storyteller's mind why it's toothless. And eventually what he does is he figures out how to sort of rig a mechanical tail feather for the broken wing, and the dragon flies again, and not only does it fly again, but it flies with Hiccup on it. And so he becomes this kind of dragon rider in the course of these events. He learns a bunch of things from Toothless about the interactions between humans and dragons. And Hiccup, sort of by virtue of his age and stage in the Viking village, is part of being trained to be a dragon tamer. There's sort of like this school for adolescent Vikings, and they all get trained. And the outstanding graduate of this class wins, as their reward for being the top Viking in that class, the opportunity to kill a dragon in the arena in front of the whole village, kind of to open the dragon games. And so this is the prize that's being held up. And so what happens is Hiccup comes back to class after kind of sneaking off to interact with Toothless, and he comes back with all this knowledge about dragons and this way of thinking about dragons that is not typical to the Vikings at all, and he starts to use that knowledge in his class, and he actually ends up being able to control any of the dragons that they bring in, and they bring in quite a variety. Some of them are quite funny. They're all meant to be fearsome in their own kind of cartoonish way, but he just kind of has this way with them. And Astrid, the girl that he has this massive crush on, is sort of this uber female warrior character in the story. She's kind of like this super Viking ninja chick. She was hilarious. She was a great character, throwing all these one leg, no arm cartwheels, you know, while holding a sword all night. She really was pretty impressive. And so she really wants to be the winner. She wants to be the super Viking, you know. And Hiccup kind of just steps in and with a completely different approach to the dragons, kind of wins that place. And so he wins this honor of being the top graduate and being queued up to kill a dragon, to open the dragon games in front of the whole village. Meanwhile, Stoic, who's been off with this fleet trying to deal with the dragon problem, comes back with this just decimated fleet. I mean, they've gotten absolutely trounced. But we already know, as observers of the story, the Stoic's kind of ashamed of his son. That he really doesn't... He really wishes Hiccup wasn't such a loser. He loves him, but, man, the kid just can't get it sorted, you know? And so Stoic comes back from this horrid enterprise that he's gone on to hear of the emergence of his son as this preeminent young tamer of dragons. And he is so proud and so pleased and so excited about the opening of the dragon games and Hiccup kind of leading this team of dragon slayers. He's just couldn't be a prouder man. Gives his son a Viking hat made of one half of his mother's breastplate. Anyway, it's a funny moment, just like you imagine it might be. It's one of a pair, sort of the actual line in the production. Given the scale of the stage, you know, you can't help but think she she must have been quite a person. And so he's, the upshot of all this, of course, is that he's really proud, right? He's just like super pumped. And so when the moment actually comes, and they, I should back up just a little bit. Subplot here about Astrid. Astrid starts to wonder what's going on with Hiccup and the dragon thing. And so one night when he sneaks off to meet with Toothless, she follows him and learns a secret and learns that he has befriended a dragon. And she is incensed. She is like, she is ready to run back to the village and blow the whole thing out of the water. And he basically doesn't let her. He more or less, the way the storyteller characterizes it, he kidnaps her. And she's furious with him, you know, because she can't believe, first of all, this is, that he's done this thing, and now he won't let her tell the story. And what ends up happening is he takes her on Toothless with him, and they take off together. And so initially she's furious, but then the experience of this whole thing kind of wins her over. And so at the end of that particular scene, she whacks him in the arm, like just nails him, just about knocks him off his perch, and she says, "That's for kidnapping me," and then she kisses him on the cheek, and she says, "That's for everything else." And something is starting to blossom here, you know. So that's kind of what's going on with Hiccup and Astrid, all right? So they bring in this horrendous dragon. It's called the Monstrous Nightmare. A little heavy-handed, but there you go. They bring in the Monstrous Nightmare, and Hiccup is at the front of the pack, and it's his job, of course, to heroically slay this dragon in front of the whole village. And what he does instead is he chooses that moment to reveal what he has learned about dragons. That is not what is commonly understood to be the case. And so he goes up to this dragon, and he kind of knows where their soft spot is. It's right under there, and if you rub them there, they get all kind of pussycat. And so he starts dealing with this dragon this way, and the dragon is kind of responding to this positively, and his father, Stoic, who has no idea about any of this, stops. He can't believe what's happening. He just shuts it down. Like, this is not what we do. We're Vikings and they're dragons, and that's not the way we interact and deal with one another. Hold it! And he gets so worked up about the process that the dragon kind of goes off again, and all the ground that Hiccup has gained within that moment is lost, and the dragon actually puts Hiccup in danger. And Toothless, who is off the scene, hears Hiccup scream and comes swooping in to rescue his friend and gets captured by the rest of the Vikings as a result, taken prisoner. And that's kind of how that, what was supposed to be a great moment, ends. Stoic figures this is the perfect time to actually eradicate the problem of the dragons. And so he puts together yet another fleet. They take the captive Toothless and harness Toothless to the fleet and say, basically, Toothless, you will lead us to the dragon's nest or you will die. Now, the other thing that's happened along the way is that when Hiccup was flying with Astrid the very first time, something happened by accident. They weren't anticipating this, but there was a whole flock of dragons that went by. And Toothless got in with this flock of dragons, and followed them back to the dragon's nest, a place the Vikings had never been. And what they discovered when they got to the dragon's nest is that the dragon's nest had at its center this horrendous, gigantic, massive dragon that was not a friend of the other dragons. In fact, that massive dragon basically held the entire dragon culture captive. And the reason the dragons raided the way that they did, the reasons the dragons behaved the way that they did in terms of taking things from the Vikings, is because if they didn't feed that dragon that was in the middle of their nest, that dragon would eat them. And so this is part of the discovery that they've made along the way. And Hiccup knows that. He can't talk about it with the Vikings, right? But he knows. And so when his father, Stoic, whom he loves, puts together this fleet and takes Toothless to be their guide to go back and deal with the dragon's nest, Hiccup, in trying to explain why his father shouldn't do that, gives away the whole story. And his father demotes him. He takes back the Viking paraphernalia and says, "You're no Viking." And he disowns him as a son. "You're no son of mine." And off he goes to deal once and for all with the dragons. This is a point in the story where Astrid confronts Hiccup and asks him why he didn't kill Toothless in the first place. And Hiccup basically says, you know, because when I looked in his eyes, I saw that we were both the same kind of afraid. There was some commonality that I hadn't expected, and I couldn't do it. I saw myself there. An important moment. We'll come back to it. Hiccup comes up with a plan to work together with the rest of the students, who are basically a bunch of buffoons, with the exception of Astrid, to save the Vikings from this crazy choice that they've made. They arrive on the scene of the dragon's nest after the Viking fleet has already uncovered this enormous horrid dragon, which is called the Red Death. And Hiccup's classmates distract this awful dragon while Hiccup goes in to rescue Toothless. They both end up underwater in one of the most remarkable moments in the whole production. You find yourself holding your breath. You physically feel like the whole stadium is at the bottom of the lake. It's incredible how they pulled it off. But not to get onto a big production tangent here. They end up on the bottom of the lake, drowning, and Stoic, repentant of having rejected his son, dives in and rescues them both. Tender moment, and it's good. Toothless, together with Hiccup and the rest of the classmates, get the Red Death Dragon out of the nest. They kind of outmaneuver it. They send it crashing to earth in this humongous fiery explosion. The explosion is so gargantuan that it kind of engulfs everyone for a few moments. It engulfs Toothless and Hiccup, and they kind of go down. Hiccup falls off. Toothless dives into the flames to save him. We kind of lose track of them for a few moments. And then when all the blowing up of things settles down and the smoke starts to clear, we can't find Hiccup. We don't know where he is, but we can see what's sort of left of Toothless, kind of this huddled mass. And eventually Stoic finds Toothless, and it's discovered that Toothless has got to me, right? Has sheltered Hiccup with his own body in this fire, right? So Hiccup is alive. Toothless is alive. They're both barely there. So they come back to the village, and Toothless, or Hiccup rather, is in a coma. He's not responsive. He's out. And he doesn't come around until Toothless shows up and kind of gets in his face, and he responds to Toothless, and he comes out of his coma, and he discovers that what has happened along the way, among other things, he's lost part of a leg and had it replaced with a prosthetic, another sort of subplot that we don't have time to talk about, but it was kind of perking along all the way through the story. He's also discovered that the dragons and the Vikings have become companions in rebuilding the dragon, the Viking village. They're working together to restore order from the chaos. And the kids are learning to ride dragons. And the story ends with all the children, this trained bunch of adolescent dragon trainers and slayers racing their dragons around the arena. So what does that all have to do? Thanks for coming to church. You can go. What does that all have to do with this text that was perking around in my head when I got to go with Tyrion to this thing? Well, the text was Acts chapter 10, which if you kind of grew up in, you know, Christendom, you might know is the story where Peter, the apostle Peter, goes into this trance and has this vision of a sheet coming down with things on it that he should eat and that he shouldn't eat. It's that story. I want to do with that story what I more or less just did with the story of Hiccup and Toothless. The story starts out with us being introduced to the character of Cornelius. Cornelius is a Roman soldier. Peter, of course, is a Jew. And Jesus has come into the story as a Jew. And the good news of what Jesus has to share with the world is a Jewish story entirely at this point. The first character we meet in Acts chapter 10 is Cornelius, not a Jew. A Gentile, a Roman, and a military Roman. He is what is called, in the context of that story, a God-fearer. And at that time in history, there was sort of this whole group of people around the Jewish people. They were the power holders in the cultural setting, but they were people who, as the Jewish storytellers relate it to us, who feared God. They were mostly people who had gotten absolutely sick and tired of kind of the subcultural excesses, the immorality, the kind of cultural breakdown that went with other religions of the day. And they were attracted to Judaism's monotheism and to the story that went with that. But they didn't become Jewish. They remained Gentiles. And so Cornelius is one of those people. And Cornelius has a vision of his own. The text actually kind of uses this interesting phrase. It says in the translation I was reading, he distinctly saw an angel of God. So he has some kind of a spiritual encounter with God. And what the angel tells him to do is to summon Peter, who the angel says is staying in another village, some distance away, and it says he's staying at this particular house. He's staying with Simon the Tanner. Like, if you go look for him, that's where you'll find him, and you should go get him and ask him to come to your house. That's sort of what happens to Cornelius. Kind of has a spiritual experience. So he actually gathers some other people from his household together that the text describes as also being devout, and he sends them off to get Peter. So there's something quite remarkable going on in this household. While those people are in transit between the two cities, Peter, so the story kind of flips back to Peter, and Peter has a vision of his own. He's hungry. He's staying with Simon the Tanner, as the angel said he would be. And kind of between meals, he gets hungry. And while he's hungry, and this is not an insignificant part of the plot, while he's hungry, he asks the host, would they prepare him a bit of a snack? And while he's waiting for this meal to be prepared, he goes up to the roof to pray. And while he's up there, he goes into a trance. And the actual word suggests that he doesn't become unaware of his surroundings. This happens while he's conscious of his environment. And he has a spiritual experience of his own. And what happens in that experience is that he sees something like a sheet or a sail. The word's a little hard to pin down in our culture. Coming down from heaven. The heavens open and this big white thing comes down. And on the big white thing are a bunch of animals. And they are animals both that as a faithful Jew he's allowed to eat and that he's not allowed to eat. And those rules were very strict and they had to do with honoring God or dishonoring God. It wasn't like if you eat these you'll get, you know, you'll have tummy trouble. It was like this is spiritual, this is not spiritual, this is right, this is wrong. They were not ambiguous categories. And the sheet comes down in front of Peter and a voice says to him, kill and eat of the whole contents of the sheet. Get up, Peter, kill and eat. And Peter says, in the translation again that I was reading, surely not, Lord, I've never eaten anything impure or unclean. And the voice says to him, do not call anything impure that God has made clean. This happens three times. Peter vigorously declines to kill and eat every time. And then the sheet goes back up to heaven. So while Peter's thinking about all of this and kind of wondering, what does that mean? This delegation from Cornelius shows up at the door. The Spirit of God says to Peter, there's going to be some people coming in just a moment. You should go with them. Sure enough, the people come. Peter goes with them. This story's already utterly remarkable on a whole bunch of levels, but here's where it just gets completely crazy, because for Peter to actually go with this delegation without protest, without explanation, for him to go with them at all is for him to walk into something that a faithful Jew would just never, ever, ever walk into. It's not the way things are. It's not the way things are done. I don't know if we can really get how big the gap is here, but a couple of ways that might kind of let us get a glimpse of this. The gap between Gentile and Jew at this point in history, Peter, as a faithful Jew, would have been somebody who woke up every morning, and if he was on task, he would have said his prayers. And one of those prayers every day would have been to thank God that he was not a Gentile. He wasn't one of those others. He was a Jew. And he wasn't just grateful to be a Jew. He was explicitly grateful to not be a Gentile. A Gentile was somebody that if you were a faithful Jew and a Gentile woman was in labor and she got into distress, you didn't help her. Because to help that baby come to live was just to add one more Gentile to the world. And that's not a gift to the world. It's part of the law. If you wanted to address yourself in conversation regarding a Gentile, uncircumcised Gentile man, the word that you used for him was dog. It was the same word. He's a dog. This is Peter's culture, and it's his culture of belief. It's his culture, the culture in which his spirituality has been formed and is rooted. It's the way things are under God. So when Cornelius sends for him and he goes, it's kind of mind-blowing already. So Peter goes with these folks and he goes to the house of Cornelius, which would ritually defile him as a faithful Jew. And then, to really kind of just drive the nail in the coffin, so to speak. He eats with these people. And then he tells them the story of Jesus. And what happens is that Cornelius and his whole household kind of joyfully embrace that faith. And then the Spirit of God, which the followers of Jesus have been experiencing in a kind of a brand new, never before in history way, comes into the room and into the people that have embraced Jesus the same way that it has for the Jews. Jeez. None of this is supposed to work like this. But it does. And in Acts 11:18, Peter and his fellow Jewish Christians, because he took some people with him, the text says, glorified God, saying, then to the Gentiles also God has granted repentance unto life. It's just, it's jaw-dropping. The sentence doesn't even begin to tell the story. What do these two stories have to do with one another? What was going on inside of me? Was I just making this up? I want you to think about it this way for a moment. Just humor me and see if this is legit. And if it's not, you can, on the way home, you can dismiss it and I and carry on with the way things have been. I'm okay with that. When Hiccup goes to find the dragon that he shot down and he locates it wounded in the forest and he rushes at it to kill it, he is doing what any good Viking would do. He is doing the thing that you do to be a Viking. This is who Vikings are. This is who dragons are. This is how Vikings and dragons interact. This is the nature of their relationship. This is the nature of their being. If you want to be a good Viking, this is what you do to dragons. Full stop. There's no other way forward in Vikingness. But when he tries to do what everyone knows is the right thing to do with a dragon, he can't do it because he sees himself in the dragon, and he sees the dragon in himself. In this case, the common ground is fear. But he also sees in that moment between Toothless and him initially, and the directors did a great job of this in the live show, he also sees that unless they move toward one another, all they have left to do is destroy one another. It's the only option. And as soon as he sees that commonality, he can no longer understand the dragon in the way that he did before, as simply the enemy, as something to either be eliminated or assimilated. He can't do it. The touring version of the show, the one that we saw, has Hiccup trying to sum up this new vantage point by saying to his kind of uber Viking dad, and anybody else that will maybe listen, the dragons aren't like we think they are. They're not the way we've always thought. They're not the beings that we have assumed them to be because of the actions that we've seen. We don't know the whole story. It's not the way we think it is. And for me, one of the most poignant moments in the entire show is when Stoic puts together this second fleet and they're going off to deal with the dragon's nest, and Hiccup has tried to tell him the story and tried to tell him the story, and his father just refuses to hear it, and Hiccup is down on his knees. He is weeping and he's just like, Father, why won't you ever listen to me? It's just this, just this huge heart cry. Great, poignant, powerful moment. Achingly difficult moment in the story. His father, of course, strides off out of that scene to do what everyone knows is the right thing to do with a dragon. And the stage goes black. What does Hiccup have in that moment that can't be embraced? I'm going to suggest that what he has that nobody else at that point in the story has is what I would call a healing perspective. It can't be embraced because the previous or prevailing perspective is so dominant, it's so powerful. And the process of carrying a vision like that forward is very costly. What happens in the book of Acts, because that's the same kind of perspective that Peter carries forward, right? You know those Gentiles, you know those dragons? They're not who we thought they were. You know how we thought they were outside the story and that the only way to deal with them was to keep them outside of the story? That's the only safe thing to do? It's not true. They could just as well be our friends as our enemies. And not just our friends as well as our enemies, but they could just as well be the friends of God as the enemies of God. What happens to Peter when he comes home with that story? Well, we know he's not making it up because he had some people with him, and so there's some credibility around this actually happened. But what happens in Acts chapter 11, the next chapter in the story, is that he gets called on the hot seat. He has to justify what he's saying. He has to offer something like an explanation. And so he has to recap the whole story, and he ends up by saying, If God is willing to extend to these others the same spirit he gave to us, quote, who was I to think that I could oppose God? It's interesting, you know, that the people who kind of call Peter onto the hot seat start out with shame. Second verse, chapter 11. You went into the house of uncircumcised men and ate with them. How could you? How could you do that? How could you be that cozy with a dragon? What, do you not understand the nature of dragonness? Do you not understand the nature of otherness? Do you not understand that this story does not extend to this kind of interaction? Do you not understand that when you snuggle up with the enemy, what you do is you let the enemy into the house? And when you let the enemy into the house, what happens to the house? The whole house gets destroyed. That's what happens. You don't treat dragons like this. You don't treat Gentiles like this. You don't ask them into the story. It's going to wreak havoc everywhere. Everything that we hold dear, everything that we've built around this narrative is going to come down in a heap. Shame, shame. If you want to be a faithful one, whether it's a Viking or a follower of Jesus, what you need to do is you need to stick with the way things are, because if you step outside of that, you are going to wreck the whole deal. And all Peter can offer in his defense is to retell a story and to offer himself in the story and say, well, here's what happened, you guys. Who am I to oppose that? See how the shape of these two stories just speaks to one another? I think it would be a good idea. I think it would be a good idea for us to, we're going to be still just for a moment. And we're going to spend that stillness, at least we may spend it, I invite you to, spend that stillness doing some dragon naming. Not out loud, but just in your own head, in your own heart. What are the kinds of things in your life, in our lives, that behave like this, that there's a prevailing understanding of them that can only be challenged by commonality, by actually stepping into relationship with the dragon? There are a couple of other important points of connection to this bigger story. The self-donation of both Hiccup and Toothless at different points in the story is really profound. And Toothless gets to play the Good Samaritan, among other things. The outcast turns out to be the rescuer. It's a really lovely moment as well, and changes a lot of things. What comes of these stories? In both these stories, what emerges from the tale is actually what I would simply call a better world. A world in which community and mutuality and love actually start to flourish. One of the things that was remarkable about the live show was the way that they worked with visuals. The visuals were stunning. A huge space, and they just found a way to make you feel like you were in it. Like you were the one flying when the dragons flew. Like you were the one underwater when the water was over your head. Like you were the one in the middle of the fire when there was a fire. It was really an awesome piece of production. And at the end of the show, one of the backdrops we've seen over and over again is this visual of the Viking village. It kind of looked like it was built in the Canadian Shield, you know, suspiciously like the Canadian Shield. And not a lot of flowers. At the end of the show, we see the same village, some things being rebuilt and starting to blossom. There's color. There's kind of beauty and new life. And there's something good happening here that wasn't happening before, is the picture. I don't know if we really understand this in our setting as Christians in the 21st century, but if Peter hadn't had this vision and hadn't acted on it, we wouldn't be here. The thing that we call Christendom is an extension of this Jewish story. It is the Jerusalem way. It has been all the way through the narrative. But it wouldn't have extended. Any Jews here? I'm not being facetious. Is there anyone here that's Jewish? I'm not aware of anyone in our community that comes from that stream of this story. But if there were, they would be the only person, without this chapter in Acts and Peter's obedience in it, they would be the only person to whom the good news of God actually extended. The rest of us would be dragons. The rest of us would be Gentiles. This is what's on the line in this story. This is the size of hinge that this story is in the narrative. The How to Train Your Dragon Spectacular ends with a screen that comes up that says something like, I didn't write it down, so this is close, Tyrion, you can help me if you remember it more clearly, but it says something like, this is how my world was changed. Or this is how my world changed. Thank you. And I think that's the kind of story this is. That's the import of this story. Now, what does that look like when we kind of bring it home? I think there's a couple of things that I kind of want us to carry away. That the story of the good news about Jesus didn't stay an exclusively Jewish story is deeply consistent with Jesus saying, I'm coming to do a new thing. And it's part of the whole arc of the story. But Davis and I were talking about this the other day, and I said that it's an interesting thing, you know, that the arc of this story doesn't actually go like this to this kind of tidy conclusion at the end as far as the way we have it at this point in history. The arc of the story actually kind of goes like this. And it just kind of poofs right out the end of the narrative and into the open space where we live. The place where we are actually called to, compelled to, the thing that you've heard me before call faithful improvisation. That we're actually called to figure out what the shape of that narrative, actually embodied shape of that narrative is right here, right now. So part of what that means, if we put it into the context of this sort of fanciful narrative of Vikings and dragons, is that there are dragons that are ours to name, that we need to say, that's what that is. That's a way of thinking about that otherizes, that puts away as an enemy to be eliminated or assimilated, somebody or somebodies. And says, that's the only way to deal with them. It's the only way we've always dealt with them. It's the only right thing to do. If you actually want to be a Viking, if you actually want to be, let's just transliterate it, if you actually want to be a Christian, this is the only way to deal with this person, this issue, this lifestyle, this culture, this, keep going, I don't care, fill in the blank, you did some dragon naming already, this issue in your life, personally, for that matter. Why? Because that's the way we deal with it. That's the way this culture of belief deals with it. It's a dragon. You bring it into the house, it wrecks the house. To go get to know the dragon is the path of life, but it's not without cost. It's not without cost. Hiccup wakes up without part of a leg. And until he sees the dragons helping to rebuild, what he experiences is grief and pain. Peter comes home from a profound experience that alters his whole paradigm of belief, and he comes home to accusation. How could you? How could you? How dare you? The recognition that this matters so much that Luke, who's the writer of Acts, regards it as so important that he gives two chapters to it. And by the way, he's writing on a scroll. Scrolls were only allowed to be 35 feet long, because if they were longer than that, you couldn't pick them up. And so it wasn't like an e-book. It wasn't like it didn't get any bigger when you added more. It got bigger. And so writers on scrolls were really careful about what they put on them. Luke gives up two chapters to this in the scroll that was Acts. It's a huge deal. And I think the people of that time understood it eventually. But not initially. Initially, there was this huge pushback. There's a couple other things that we should pay attention to, though. Oh, Peter, by the way, ends up in prison. Happy day. It's just not uncomplicated. It doesn't settle into a fairy tale. And that's partly because the ark doesn't come back down, right? That's partly because the ark keeps on going. He doesn't stay in prison either. More goes on. In fact, as the oral history would have it, Peter ends up being crucified, but he asks to be crucified, martyred upside down, because he's not worthy to be crucified right side up, because Jesus died that way. Anyways, whole other story. But it just doesn't settle out into a fairy tale. And one of the reasons it doesn't settle out into a fairy tale is because Not all those questions are answered. Not all those things are dealt with. That's where we live. That's what we get to do. One of the other things I think is really important to note, just briefly, and I'm going to wrap here shortly, but is that this isn't a vertical story. When Cornelius has this experience where Peter comes and knows him and he knows Peter and the Spirit of God flows into this story and meets everyone, the first thing Cornelius does is he falls down in front of Peter. Falls down on his knees. And Peter just reaches down and picks him up and just says, in essence, this isn't that kind of story. I didn't come to you as superior. And I am not now superior. There is no groveling in this kingdom. If, perchance, you or I choose to name and face a dragon, and if, perchance, in discovering the commonality of facing that dragon, we also discover a place of new life and something good blossoms, we just need to know that's the way this story is meant to go. It's not a moment for self-congratulation, but it is a moment for celebration. Why isn't it a moment for self-congratulation? I mean, didn't we face the dragon? Well, who are we, first of all, to say that the dragon didn't have some facing down to do of its own? And that's one of the things that this story of Hiccup and Toothless tells us so eloquently. It's about the mutuality of this struggle. There's one being in this story who actually has a big enough vantage point to see the whole story, and that being is God, not us. And that's who we answer to when we're called into this stuff. And that's who we celebrate in the presence of when these things produce new life and mutual hope and mutual love. I'm not saying this is uncomplicated. I'm not saying it's dead obvious. I'm not saying that it's always going to be clear. I'm sure maybe, you know, somebody, the story, Acts doesn't tell us because it kind of has to compress this all into two chapters, including Peter's interrogation, but did nobody have any moments of doubt in this story? I mean, really. It's so crazy. Somebody must have had some moment where they went, okay, and didn't just jump right in, you know. So that happens, right? It's part of it. But the story, in the end, is a story about listening to the Spirit, who sometimes says things to individuals before they get said to the masses. And so sometimes it seems like the way these narratives unfold, there's something for us to do, something for us to answer to, that means we're going to end up on the other end of that story being said, you just can't behave that way with the dragon. It's not going to end well. It's not done. But when we're obedient in that, and we carry that story forward, even though it may cost us a great deal, if we are listening to the Spirit, then a kind of life that hasn't been there before is going to start to emerge from that. And that's how this changes. And in the end, these are all things that we have to live to know. They're not theories. They're things that require embodied testing. They're things of which we might say everything is at stake in them. And the result just might be new life.